welcome to Backchat. Hello to everyone in Bristol, to listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and the QADO in Hertfordshire, and to our listeners in Swindon. Hello Swindon FM, and hello to our new listeners in Cirencester in the Cotswolds. I'm James Melia.
And I'm Kirsty Paul. Coming up in the show.
There was a boy here when Wordsworth was here called William Pearson. He was at the same time as Wordsworth, and he founded the British Astronomical Society. See, this school produced quite a lot of good mathematicians. Although they were doing Latin and Greek, it was classed as the best in the north of England for mathematics by Cambridge University. And, of course, Wordsworth was an excellent mathematician.
We visit Hawkshead in the Lake District, where Wordsworth went to school.
The toilers had mostly given over. Their ploughs and harrows were left to the abandoned fields. They had taken their wages and gone, or were going, home. But at the crown of the hill a black barn stood by the roadside, and in its yard, amid sounds of anguish, a score of young boar pigs were being gelded by two brown lads and a gypsy fellow.
Malcolm Grieve reads a short story. Our first studio guest is a regular contributor to the Backchat, and he's here this week to talk about Edmund Burke. So welcome to Andrew Brown. Okay, so you're going to talk today about Edmund Burke, who was MP for Bristol back in the 18th century?
Yes, that's right. It was something that really came from a talk I did a few weeks ago, some of you might remember, on the famous riot in Queen Square in Bristol in 1831, which was just very close to where we are now, making this recording. And it made me think then that it's rather strange as you walk through Queen Square that there's nothing now to record that this riot of great significance for our collective political history, you know, because it brought about, helped to bring about the Great Reform Act of 1830. There's nothing there. If you work across the square into what we call the centre in Bristol, there's quite an interesting statue, though, that does record the fact that we had a man between 1774 and 1780 as one of our MPs in the city called Edmund Burke, who was actually an Irish gentleman. And serious political historians, not only in this country but also in America, have sometimes suggested that he's the greatest single MP that we have ever had as an independent backbencher. He never led a party as Prime Minister, but his influence as a political thinker, his speeches in Parliament, his writings, his pamphlets have had an enormous influence on English politics. And I'd just like to read you what's on the statue plinth out there in the centre, which was erected by another MP for Bristol at a later time. It's a bronze statue sitting on a big granite plinth, and the granite plinth has an inscription. It says Burke, 1774 to 1780, which is when Edmund Burke was MP in Bristol. And it has a quotation from a speech he's said to have made actually as he stood down as MP in 1780, because he knew that he didn't have the backing of the local electorate anymore. And he said to them, really, I think, something of a passing shot, "I wish to be a member of Parliament to have my share of doing good and resisting evil." And by implication, he's almost saying, well, I can't really do that in Bristol because you won't support what I'm trying to work on. Now, if a politician said that now, I think it might put our teeth on edge a little bit, because we're a bit suspicious about politicians who claim to have moral or religious agendas because of our recent past. I think if you look at the history of what Burke actually achieved within the context of the 18th century, there is some substance to this. He did try to do good as an MP. He did try to resist evil. And I just would like to go through a few of the points that one can sort of draw out to substantiate that, because we live in a time when we don't often think very highly of our politicians, and they don't really like us very much sometimes. So who was Edmund Burke? Well, there have been very different approaches to this. He actually, in simple terms, he was an Irish-born son of a gentleman who was born in 1729, we think, possibly in Cork. He became an MP in England and stood for various different constituencies, not just Bristol. The famous Jewish philosopher of politics in the 19th century, Karl Marx, said that he was a vulgar bourgeois in the pay of the American colonists. Now, he wasn't actually a bourgeois. Why Marx would use a word like vulgar if Marx was supposed to be a man of the people, I don't know. But he wasn't in the pay of American colonists. So people have found it convenient to sort of say things about him that aren't true. More recently, a famous historian of 18th century politics in this country called Sir Lewis Namier, said that everyone in 18th century politics in England was out to cut a figure to make themselves look good, but that there was no serious substance to this, and he particularly was thinking of Burke. Again, I think that's unfair. So let's just go through a few of the things that Burke tried to do, which I would say were perhaps to do with doing good and resisting evil. From his very good education in Ireland, where he was brought up to be an Anglican but with Roman Catholic sympathies and in a Quaker school, which is a very broad education, he studied philosophy at the Anglican University in Dublin with some obviously very good teachers. He was a great pupil. And he came from Ireland to England. He wanted at first perhaps to be a writer. He became involved in politics, but with a very good basis already of thinking out problems with the help of philosophers like the Englishman John Locke, the great Irish philosopher Bishop Berkeley, later on Hume. He knew something of Aristotle. He wanted to be involved in practical affairs, but he had a marvellously well-stocked brain before he started, if you like. He could construct arguments. He knew what the philosophers had to say. So he came to England and he got a job with a political man. He got elected as an MP for a while. And the first really big thing he wanted to do was to try and relieve the burden of what was called the penal law against Irishmen and anybody in this country who was a Roman Catholic. So he was trying to make life better for those people, and I would say that that was good. He then tried to warn England that its policies towards the American colonists would lead to a war and would lead to the loss of the American colonies. And he did this well before it actually happened. He said that they should have freedom to tax themselves, and he was proved right. In 1774, he was elected to be an MP in Bristol because he spoke for free trade. He was against monopolies. But of course, the Bristolians actually wanted free trade on their terms. They didn't want free trade for the Irish. And this led him eventually to stand down because he was a man of principle and he wouldn't simply do what the electors told him to do if he thought it was wrong. You know, he was quite had some sort of moral core, if you like. Now, it didn't stop there because he went on to carry on in politics, and one of his later achievements was to point to what was going on in India, which in some ways was rather like a bigger version of what was going on in Ireland. The East India Company at that time was trying to make vast amounts of money from Indian agriculture. They pushed the Bengali workers far too hard. It helped to bring about famine. It was almost slavery. Burke wanted to bring this to light, and he tried to impeach in Parliament in England the director of the East India Company in Bengal, a man called Warren Hastings. That was one of his misjudgments, I think, because it was too much, what we say in philosophy, ad hominem, too much the man, not enough the issue, and it didn't work. But he was still trying to do, I think, you know, what was good work to help the Indians, and he respected Indian culture. The last great achievement in politics is different again, I think, but again it's to do with this issue of fundamental moral issues. As the French Revolution broke out in 1789, people in this country who were liberals, like Burke, initially cautiously supported what was going on. He admired the spirit of reform in France. But when it turned out to be attacks on people, including the king and the queen and the church, he radically changed his view because he was always against violence and force in politics. He had a Quaker education. And he started to put together intellectual ideas to underpin an attack on the Jacobins, the extremist leaders of intellectual revolution in France. And he realised that their great poster boy was Rousseau, and he showed that some of Rousseau's ideas, which were very popular in the 18th century, could be shown to be not necessarily humanitarian ideas. They could lead to totalitarian regimes and to terror. Now, he did this in 1790. That's 3 years before it actually happened in France. So because, again, of his care to examine a subject and to study it, to think about principles, he was able to warn what was likely to happen. He got it right, and he warned that there could be terrible consequences for France. People in England at the time weren't sure. After 1793, of course, they were. So this is another contribution, I think, where you can see that he was trying to do good and resist evil. What, of course, happened in France eventually during the Terror was that thousands of ordinary people, as well as aristocrats and politicians, were executed in public. Very much larger number of people were killed in rural genocides. France attacked every country in Europe for virtually over 25 years, leading to probably millions of deaths. So, you know, Burke was onto something when he started to criticise the French Revolution. But he did so not because he believed in l'ancien régime. He told the French they'd have to change. So I'd just like to finish with a few of the things that he actually said to give you a little flavour of how he spoke. He was a great speaker and writer. He was also a romantic. He said about France during the Revolution, because of the tax on women, on ladies and on the Queen and on children, the age of chivalry is gone. That of sophisters, economists and calculators has succeeded and the glory of Europe is extinguished. Now, we wouldn't take that now, but it sort of worked in romantic times. He also said about this, what he thought was the problem of the thinkers in France, that an abstract liberty, like any other mere abstraction, is not to be found. In other words, it wouldn't necessarily lead to freedom. He said that liberty must be limited in order to be possessed. In other words, this extreme cult of freedom that Rousseau and Robespierre tried to bring about could actually lead to terror, and it did. Again, showing the balance of his mind, he said, I am not one of those who think that the people are never in the wrong, and there have been so many examples in recent history where that can be shown to be true. Yet, in all forms of government, the people is the true legislator. So it's balanced. You know, he was a remarkably philosophical thinker in many respects. Lastly, I'd like to point out that he said about France that a state without the means of some change is without the means of its conservation. So some people have called him a conservative thinker, but that may be misleading. And my own way of trying to sum him up, I think, would be to say that I think he did try to do good and to resist evil in his political life over many years, and that we need people like that now in many ways. We need modern Burkes. Wordsworth said of him that he was a great man, like a great oak. And I finished with Wordsworth's famous lines about Milton. Milton was a poet who was also a politician, and Wordsworth felt in his time that there needed to be spiritual leadership in political life. And he said, Milton, thou shouldst be living at this hour. England hath need of thee. Now, today, honestly, I would say we don't need Milton. His ideas led to tyranny. We need somebody like Burke. We need somebody with a cool head, a well-stocked brain, who thinks before they speak, who has a moral compass that's real, who resists force, who does good.
Thanks there to Andrew Brown, who was talking about Edmund Burke. Not all politicians can live up to Burke's moral values, especially in the modern age. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Wimmill Hill, is here with a poem about two disgraced people from the political scene, Vicky Price and Chris Hoon. Both are expected to be released during the month of May after serving only a quarter of their sentences. Prosecutors are also claiming a sum of £108,541 from Hoon.
Three lessons. Big deal maker, fornicator, obliterates himself in style, trades his wife for younger model, seems in love with his own guile. Wife publicizes dodgy dealings, schemes to bring the big beast down, war of words and bitter feelings, Mr. Big hands in his crown. Wife ignores the consequences, thinks she can escape the rap, pins a hope on weak defences, gets ravelled up in her own trap. Three lessons of the sad, sad story. Vengeance is not always sweet. A Pyrrhic victory brings no glory. Some fights are best kept discreet.
Trip now north to Grasmere and the home of Wordsworth. We visit Dove Cottage and then on to Hawkshead, where Wordsworth went to school at the age of 9.
We're just going into Dove Cottage. So this is the front door. We're going into a lovely panelled room. It's very dark in here.
Yes, no electricity in the times of the Wordsworths were here, and we try and keep it as authentic as possible. So there's minimal lighting. The poor Sir Wordsworths arrived to live in here in 1799. Though there was no electricity and no running water in those days, and no internal sanitation either.
Well, it feels very warm in here. Is this exactly how it would have been when
he would he would definitely recognise the house as it is today. The panelling is dark from top to toe because Dove Cottage used to be a pub before the Wordsworths moved in. So the panelling would be there to hide nicotine stains and beer splashes. The slate floor that you can see is not contemporary with a normal Lakeland cottage of that time because slate was far too expensive. So you can see that the day of the 20th of December, which is the day the Wordsworths arrived, and they arrived at 4:45, there would have been very little light in this room at all. So in this room, which we call the house place, was basically a kitchen parlour. It's where the ladies would have actually baked or sewn around the dining room table. We know that coming here was really a dream come true for the sister Dorothy, and it was only financially possible for William to come here on an inheritance he got from Raisley Calvert, who was a university friend who died at 22 from tuberculosis, or what they call consumption. The £900 gave an income of about £70 a year, which was just enough for both sister and brother to live here without having to go to work. Dorothy was the housekeeper, and she came to keep things just right so William didn't have to worry about domestic natures or things, because that was good, because he thought matters of a domestic nature troubled his mind. So while they were here, not only did he marry Mary Hutchinson and had three of their five children in this house, and the only reason they left this house was there was a fourth baby on the way and they need bigger premises, but they entertained here. People of the same ilk sort of hung together, those of similar political views, literary views. In fact, Wordsworth, when he was down in Somerset there, when he was at Alfoxton, was actually considered a subversive, and the government were keeping an eye on him because he and Coleridge used to walk across the cliffs and that at night. And who would do that if they weren't a spy or a smuggler? So they really were very radical. Wordsworth also entertained Hazlitt at Alfoxton.
We can hear a clock ticking in the background.
That's on the stairs going upstairs, and we have two clocks in the house. One's a cuckoo clock given to Wordsworth for his 70th birthday by Isabella Fenwick. The second clock is a long case clock that they bought on the 20th of December 1799, and we know that specifically because they'd walked from Mary Hutchinson's house, and some of it they're almost on hands and knees because the weather was so bad, but they stopped in Kendal on the third evening, and on the fourth morning they'd gone to Kendal Market and bought things for this house, and one of them was this clock, and it cost them 7 and 6 pence. Downstairs room, which we call Dorothy's bedroom, because this is the room that she chose to sleep in. As you can see, it's very dark indeed, and it's decorated in a similar fashion to next door, and so that the panelling is all stained. We've populated it with items from the collection, including a double washstand believed to be Mary and William's. And, as of course, there's no running water in those days. Just a jug would have been held in the cupboard underneath, and they'd pour water into the jug. They minimalised their hygiene processes because they thought a layer of grime protected them from bacteria. We also know from the diaries, particularly, that the great wash was only once every 5 weeks, whether your clothes needed it or not. In a dish, we have little bits of dogwood, which we bring from outside. It's a facsimile of dental hygiene. So you can see that the top is all chivied with little bits. Dogwood doesn't splinter. And with salt, we know that they would perhaps, like a toothpick, take the gunge from their teeth. For Dorothy, his sister, we do know that it perhaps wasn't as efficient as it might be because she lost all her teeth before she was 40. We know that she had a wooden pair made for her and that William called them her clackers. They weren't particularly comfortable because she only put them in when visitors were going to call. Certain pictures that you see on the wall, we have one of Dorothy in the red cabinet. It's only a silhouette. It's the only known image we have of her as a younger woman. From the writings of Thomas de Quincey, she was wild and startling-eyed and had an Egyptian complexion. Well, if you read the journals, you'll find out that she loved gardening and fell walking and was out in all weathers. So I think she was just weather-beaten, you know, just suntanned. The picture in the middle of the lady in her later years is Mary Hutchinson. She and William had known each other since they were 5 years old. They'd gone to school, in kindergarten or dame school, in Penrith. The other silhouette on the wall is of Sarah Hutchinson, Mary's sister. So like Dorothy, she came to live with her sibling in Dove Cottage. So there was no lack of domestic help in that respect.
We're going through to a lovely warm room here with a fire burning. This is must be the kitchen.
It is the kitchen proper, and as you can see, the ceiling is much lower in here. If you look out the window, we're actually underground, and this shows you that the house is being built into the hillside. And the garden that the Wordsworths called their domestic slip of mountain, they actually landscape themselves. We have the most major differences in the house in this room, but we do know they had a range of sorts, because in the diaries Dorothy said that she baked. So we know she baked things like gingerbread and giblet pies and things like that. They would have drunk coffee, even though it was expensive, and they would probably have drunk more coffee than tea, because tea was three times as expensive. We also have a patch on the wall here. This is dark brown. If you can see, it's beveled, and that is all the layers of whitewash that have been on this in there since they were here. Now, the reason the wall is that really dark brown is they didn't buy beeswax candles. They made their own out of mutton tallow. So mutton tallow is a very smoky, very acrid, and actually a very poor light. On the mantelpiece above the range, you can actually see a facsimile of a candle. It's quite stumpy and poor. And there's a rush light going through the clip. A rush from the field has been dipped and put in the clip to make this rustic candelabra. When you light all three points, it will give you a third more light. And we have a saying in the English language, burning your candle at both ends. It comes from this. Now, we're in the country, and we've got candles that are made out of mutton fat. So there's a canister hanging on the wall so that the mice and rats in the area don't go and eat them, because that would be awful, wouldn't it, to lose it to the things. And we do know that they were troubled with mice at that time, because Dorothy writes to one of her friends in her letters saying they've had to get a cat because they have too many mice and rats about.
It feels very dry in here, but it would have been damp, wouldn't it, in those days?
You would find most of the fires on most of the time, unless it was really hot outside. The walls are 3-4 feet thick, and therefore, you know, it retain moisture and get damp quite quickly. So on most days, unless we've had a really hot run of weather, you will find at least one fire on in the cottage, just to keep it dry. Now, and another thing, we have a little pantry here, and it just has pots and pans and things like that, but we know they kept flour and salt and oatmeal in there. We have another room coming off to my left-hand side, and it is actually a walk-in fridge. It's known as the buttery, because this is where the butts of ale were kept when this was a pub. It's very cold in here, and as you can see, there's three outside walls, and we are completely underground. And if you touch the slab, the stone slab here, it's like any granny's larder. That's where you keep your meat fresh for at least 2 weeks. But we have a river running underneath here. And if we ever get a deluge or a heavy period of rain, it will actually come up through the slates.
We're going up the stairs now to the first floor.
This is what we know as the sitting room. The view from here was wonderful. He wrote a letter to his sister when he was up in Grasmere earlier in 1799, telling her that he had seen a lakeside cottage. So he would have seen the fields and the fells. And along today, where the sun is brilliant, it would have been an absolutely awesome view. Of course, the furniture in here is from the collection and is part of Wordsworth's life story, because they moved from Allen Bank through to the rectory and then on to Rydal Mount. So a lot of this furniture would have actually been in Rydal Mount and not here. But the couch features in I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. Upon my couch I lie, often in an impensive mood.
What about the cover?
They were made by Dorothy and Mary. They are the originals, and they're well preserved. The pictures on the wall show Wordsworth in three different phases of his life. The youngest of him, when he's about 28, is near the door, and this is how he would have looked when he met Coleridge in Nether Stowey. We're told that Coleridge was so keen on meeting him that he didn't bother to open the gate. He actually ran through a field and jumped over a five-bar gate. The picture of himself that Wordsworth liked best is the one next to it, taken when he was about 48. It's known affectionately as the brigand portrait, as Wordsworth thought it made him look like a brigand or a pirate.
Quite a prominent nose, quite Roman nose, didn't it?
Very much a family feature. Above the mantelpiece in this room is what we would call our iconic image. It's the only known image of him taken while he was living in Dove Cottage. and it was by a society painter called Edridge, who flattered all his sitters. In the case alongside the mantelpiece and fireplace, we have evidence of William's sporting prowess. There's a couple of very early ice skates. In fact, a letter to Coleridge on Boxing Day in 1799 states that he was going to buy himself a pair of skates and give himself to the wind. He learnt while he was at Hawkshead Grammar School on Esthwaite Water and was particularly, it was above average. We knew he can do his W's quite well. But according to Thomas de Quincey, he looked like a dancing cow. So he can't have been that elegant. Come into William's bedroom. That picture is of Peel Castle. It inspired Wordsworth to write a poem about the death of his brother. His brother died in a shipwreck in 1805 off the coast of Britain. 1805 starts the mark of a change of attitude because of the loss of the brother to the whole family. It really did cast a shadow. When they moved to Allenbank, so that was 1808 to 1814, they lost two children in a very short period of time, which is why they didn't stay at the rectory so long. They actually moved to Rydalmount quite quickly. But, of course, they lost their parents when they were very young, so they were traumatised quite early on, with mother dying when Dorothy was only six and Wordsworth was 7½, and father dying 6 years later. So although it wasn't a rare occurrence, it did actually bring them both much closer together, because Dorothy had never wanted to actually live with anybody else, but she didn't meet her brothers until she was 16 after that, so she was away from the family home for 10 years. She was the middle of five children, one older than William, who was Richard. He was a barrister or a solicitor in London in the end, and then John, who was the captain, and then the Christopher, who started the branch of the clergy. He was a bishop. We'll just go through to William's bedroom, where you can see William and Mary's double bed.
Bed, it's only 4 foot wide.
Yes, very small, isn't it? But people were not as tall or as wide as we are nowadays. But also we believe that most people actually sat up to go to sleep because they were worried of consumption, and though sitting up seemed to be, you know, help the things. But the coverlet on it is also an original. It's a beautiful quilt with patchwork on it.
So who made the quilt?
The family would have done. It would have been Dorothy or Aunt Mary who done it, because it is 200 years old. This is the Poet Laureate's certificate saying that when Wordsworth was 73, he became for Queen Victoria. There's an intriguing story that he actually refused twice after the death of Southey, saying that he was too old to do the post and that Tennyson would be better. But Robert Peel, the Prime Minister, wrote a very flattering letter saying that Queen Victoria needed the greatest living poet in the land. Wordsworth said that he couldn't write poetry to order, but they agreed that he would write poetry when inspired, and for that he'd get paid 60 guineas a year, so that's £63 basically, and a very large hogshead vat of Madeira wine given to him at Christmas. He never once published anything for Queen Victoria. Wordsworth and Coleridge, they were known as the Lakes Poets. We know that this means that they were inspired by scenery and things, but we think that Byron called them the Lakes Poets because they'd only travelled over lakes and not over oceans.
How many visitors does it attract a year, roughly?
On a bad year, we have over 50,000 visitors per year. And in our zenith in the very early 90s, we had 89,000 that year. So it fluctuates with holidays and school trips and overseas visitors. Wordsworth Trust bought this by public subscription for £650 in 1890.
We're here in the very school that William Wordsworth attended in Hawkshead.
That's
and I'm
right.
Here with the curator. Hello.
Hello. My name's David Warren, and I shall tell you a little about his education.
We're standing exactly in front of the desk where he sat.
That's right. It just says W. Wordsworth. I, of course, was not here 230 years ago to witness this.
But he scratched it in the wood.
As far as we know, he possibly did. I can't say for certain, of course, no one can.
Could you give us some dates when he was here?
He was here from 1779, when he was 9 years old, And then he left here when he was 17 to go to Cambridge University, St John's College.
Oh, so there wasn't any middle school or...?
No, in those days there was just grammar school, then university.
Is there anything known about what happened while he was here at school?
Well, like all the boys, he'd have to start lessons at 6 o'clock in the morning, continue till 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 days a week, with a pure curriculum, like any grammar school in the country, of Latin, Greek and mathematics.
Was this a private school?
Yeah, it was a boarding school as well. There were 100 boys at the school when Wordsworth was here, and 90% were boarders, not local boys.
And where did they sleep?
Just outside the school, there is a large white house. And the headmaster lived in the house, and he had 40 boys lodging in his house. There's a large bookshop in the village today, which also had 40 boys in it. But Wordsworth, he stayed with a lady called Anne Tyson. She was an old lady who just put boys up whilst they were at school. And she had about 8 or 9 boys.
Oh, there's an Anne Tyson's bed and breakfast in the village?
Yeah, well, just round the corner from that is her cottage. And Wordsworth and his brothers, because all four of them, they stayed with her.
So would they have worn uniform?
Not originally, no. Not long after Wordsworth left, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, then they had a uniform, which was like a blue jacket, breeches and yellow stockings.
On display, you've got some slates.
That's right. These, very similar to what I use, but the boys would use slates with slate pencils, because if they were young boys, paper being expensive, they weren't risking it with young boys wasting paper. So paper would come in as they got older. But I remember using slates when I was in my infants class, hitting the boy in front with on the head with it, you know, dipping the girl's pigtails in the ink.
So it's very bare, isn't it, this school? And it's very small.
It is, but in this room, the downstairs room, there were 70 boys and 30 older boys upstairs. So it was busy.
And how would they have heated it?
There was a fire, but there again, if you got 70 bodies in here with body heat, I suppose it would warm up. Mix that in with the lovely smell, of course, there would be, because no one bathed very much in those days.
Was anyone else famous here?
There was a boy here when Wordsworth was here called William Pearson. He was at the same time as Wordsworth, and he founded the British Astronomical Society. See, this school produced quite a lot of good mathematicians. Although they were doing Latin and Greek, it was classed as the best in the north of England for mathematics by Cambridge University. And, of course, Wordsworth was an excellent mathematician.
Wordsworth's most famous poem was Daffodils. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils.
Still in Lake District, a track now from Will Lloyd called Kathleen. Will lives near Kendal and he's a nephew of George Lloyd, composer. His music could be heard Last Night of the Proms 2013.
See the sun won't shine today. insane. I've got to stop the pain. Maybe I'll go down to see Kathleen. Maybe I'll go down to see Kathleen. Swallow comes to tell me of her dream. Says she'd like to know just what they mean. I feel like I could die as I watch them flying by. Ride the north wind down to see Kathleen. Ocean's roar. The moon is come to lead me to her door. There's crystal across the sand, and the waves they take my hand. Soon I'm going down. Soon I'm going down to see Kathleen. Soon I'm going down to see
So we have in the studio our award-winning gardener, Jodie Fairies. So I understand that you're going to be telling us about composting.
Yes, it's something that everybody should be able to do in the garden, unless you've got a very small little yard. But on the whole, any kitchen scraps or anything coming out of the garden cuttings and prunings and trimmings, it's a really wise idea to be composting that. Rather than buying in any compost from a garden centre, you can just create your own, and it's free, makes use of the waste that you've got in your house, and it can be a great soil improver, adding nutrients to the garden. It's good on so many levels today. Everybody likes recycling things, and what better way of doing that?
So we would think about the stuff that we'd put in the food recycling bins to put in our compost bins instead.
Garden waste is usually what people put in a compost heap, but kitchen waste as well.
What do we put into a compost bin?
Well, there's two places that most of the waste comes from. Your garden or your kitchen. For anybody that's got kitchen waste, almost anything could be composted, but you're really looking for uncooked food waste. As soon as you start adding cooked food waste, it attracts the pests and the vermin, like the rats, that people don't want to get in there. As a general rule, fruit and veg peelings and anything, even rotten fruit that you're not going to eat. And occasionally, if you get any shredded paper or cardboard, you can cut that down and break that down or tear it into shreds to put on there. It just adds a really good structure to the compost as it's breaking down anyway. And unwanted newspapers, just the odd one or two newspapers, just put those into the compost heap. And then from the garden, obviously, you've got weeds that are coming out of the garden, prunings and your hedge trimmings and all your herbaceous plants during the year as they get cut back. They just die off naturally. Just trim them off, put them on there. Trying to avoid things like your perennial weeds, dandelions especially, and bindweed and ground elder. There's some really nasty ones that if they get into your compost heap, if your compost heap is working very well, that won't be a problem. But most people, or quite a few people, will struggle to get a good temperature into their compost heap. With compost, it breaks down using a very hot process. Inside that heap, you'll see it in winter, you see the steam coming off it, and there's a lot of heat in there, which is the process of it breaking down. And that will generally kill off even seed heads and perennial weeds. But if that ever doesn't maintain that temperature, those things get into your compost heap, and then later on when you spread them around, you're spreading the worst plants and weeds and things you just don't want in places of your garden, and you're giving it a head start by putting it in compost to start with as well. So with any hedge prunings or shrub prunings, just shred them up with a garden shears, small as you can. The smaller they are, the quicker that's going to break down and create a nice, softer material.
Is there anything we shouldn't put on our compost heap?
Grass clippings. You want to be putting those on the compost heap, but you don't want to put an excessive amount on there. In a standard compost heap with a mix of grass clippings and annual weeds, just the small stuff that comes out with a hoe out of your garden borders, probably about 20 to 50% of the compost heap should be made up of that and no more. Once you start crossing 50%, you'll end up with a bit of a slimy mess that, as it's breaking down, that does create a smell. If you do get into that position, you really want to be adding in some more of your, maybe some more dry leaves and some prunings of more shrubby material.
Now, I heard you're not supposed to put eggs on a compost heap. Is that true?
Eggshells I would do. Mm-hmm. I personally would put an eggshell. Eggs themselves, probably not. In the same way as cooked food waste, I would leave those out. If your compost heap is working very well, you've been turning it on a regular basis, the rats will probably not want to be in there anyway while you're turning it. And it should have such a high intensity of heat, they won't want to be in that centre any, you know, during the height of summer, certainly not.
So if you're getting rats, then the good idea is to go and turn your compost heap.
Turn it and make sure that the mix is right with a 50% of the green clippings and 50% at least with the more shredded paper and a tougher material, really. And that should just naturally in itself create a good compost. But if you do find that you're getting too much green waste, your main thing going on there is grass clippings, you can start adding some nitrogen. You can go to a garden centre and get some carbon activators. So these things are available, but just go down to your local garden centre and they'll be able to advise on that. You want to be turning it at least every month. You want to get that air in there. You want to keep it a nice, moist, not soaking wet. By keeping on top of it, you'll end up with good compost within about 6 months to 2 years. One thing that I would recommend, though, is if you've got some large trees in your garden that every autumn cover your whole lawn in lots of leaves, keep those leaves out of your compost and put those into a separate leaf container. You can put those into black bin bags or build your own little container just to put the leaves in. The reason that it's good to keep those out is leaf mould in itself, if you break down all those leaves, becomes very, very good for your garden and the soil structure. It improves the actual structure of the soil itself, adds a little bit of a nutrients like your compost will. But if you've got a clay soil, it's absolutely perfect. Get digging in as much of that as possible every year. But leaves off trees will take about 2 years to break down, and they go through a different process. Leaves go through a cold composting process, so it's a different technique for breaking down. And if you can keep the two separate, you'll end up with a very good leaf mould and a very good compost. And together, that's every gardener's dream. Other things that you might want to consider putting onto a compost heap, which don't come out necessarily out of a kitchen or the garden, if you've got guinea pigs or hamsters, the sawdust or the wood shavings or even the little bedding straw, they're perfect. Put those on. You don't want to be putting cat and dog waste onto there. There's all sorts of different bacteria to any sort of hamsters, and very rarely, you know, you don't really want that mix anywhere near your compost or your garden waste. Certainly not your fruit and veg anyway. That bacteria should be kept very, very separate. One other tip that I would recommend, if you've got a patch in your garden of a lot of nettles, you can put nettles onto a compost heap. Avoid putting any of the root system onto it, but the nettle cuttings, trimmings, can go straight onto a compost. They're quite good for it anyway. But you can use those in a different way. Cut the nettles and put them into a bucket or a container. Just break them and bruise them a little bit if you can do so, but almost fill a bucket with nettles, fill it up with water, and then leave it for about 4 weeks. Everything that's in those nettles will seep out into the water, and you'll end up with a very, very strong liquid fertiliser. It'll be so strong, don't put that straight onto your plants. You want to dilute that to from about one part of, from that bucket to about 10 parts water, and sprinkle it over virtually everything in your garden, and most of it will really benefit from that.
That's a great use of stinging nettles. I have no idea. Brilliant. Yeah. Thank you very much, Jodie, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave, to Jodie Farish for our regular garden advice. Malcolm Grieve now reads a short story.
Weep Not, My Wanton, by A.E. Coppard. Air and light on sack down at summer sunset were soft as ointment and sweet as milk. At least, that is the notion the down might give to a mind that bloomed within its calm horizons. Some happy victim of romance it might be, watching the silken barley moving in its lower fields with the slow movement of summer sea, reaching no harbour, having no end. The toilers had mostly given over. Their ploughs and harrows were left to the abandoned fields. They had taken their wages and gone, or were going, home. But at the crown of the hill a black barn stood by the roadside, and in its yard, amid sounds of anguish, a score of young boar pigs were being gelded by two brown lads and a gypsy fellow. Not half a mile of distance here could enclose you the compass of their cries. If a man desired peace, he would step fast down the hill toward Arwall, with finger in ear, until he came to quiet at a bank overlooking slopes of barley, and could perceive the fogs of June being born in the standing grass beyond. Four figures, a labourer and his family, travelled slowly up the road proceeding across the hill, a sound mingling dully with their steps, the voice of the man. You could not tell if it were the noise of voice or of footsteps that first came into your ear, but it could be defined on their advance as the voice of a man upbraiding his little son.
"You're a naughty, naughty, you're a very, very naughty boy. I can't think what's come into you."
The father towered above the tiny figure shuffling under his elbow and kept his eyes stupidly fixed upon him. He saw a thin boy, a spare boy, a very shrunken boy of 7 or 8 years, crying quietly. He let no grief out of his lip, but his white face was streaming with dirty tears. He wore a man's cap, an unclean sailor jacket, large knickerbockers that made a mockery of his lean joints, a pair of women's button boots, and he looked straight ahead.
"The idea! To go and lose a sixpence like that, then? Where do you think you'll land yourself, eh? Where'd I be if I kept on losing sixpences, eh? A creature like you, eh?"
And lifting his heavy hand, the man struck the boy a blow behind with shock enough to disturb a heifer. They went on, the child with sobs that you could feel rather than hear. As they passed the black barn, the gypsy bawled encouragingly,
"S'help me, father, that's a good'un. Wallop his trousers."
But the man ignored him, as he ignored the yell of the pig and the voice of the lark rioting above them all. He continued his litany.
"You're a naughty, naughty boy, and I dunno what's come into you."
The woman, a poor slip of a woman she was, walked behind them with a smaller child. She seemed to have no desire to shield the boy, or to placate the man. She did not seem to notice them, and led the toddling babe, to whom she gabbled, some paces in the rear of the man of anger. He was a great figure, with a bronzed face. His trousers were tied at the knee, his wicker bag was slung over his shoulder. With his free and massive hand he held the hand of the boy. He was slightly drunk, and he walked with his legs somewhat wide, at the beginning of each stride lifting his heel higher than was required, and at the end of it placing his foot firmly but obliquely inwards. There were two bright medals on the breast of his waistcoat, presumably for valour. He was perhaps a man who would stand upon his rights and his dignities, such as they were. But then he was drunk. His language, oddly unprofane, gave a subtle and mean point to his decline from the heroic standard. He only ceased his complaining to gaze swayingly at the boy, and then he struck him. The boy, crying quietly, made no effort to avoid or resist him.
"You understand me, you bad boy. As long as you're with me, you've got to come under collar. And where will you be next? I dunno. A bad creature like you, eh? And then to turn round and answer me, I dunno. I don't know what's come into you. You know you lost that sixpence through glamouring about. Where'd you lose it, eh? Where'd you lose it, eh?"
At these questions he seized the boy by the neck and shook him as a child does a bottle of water. The baby behind them was taken with little gusts of laughter at the sight, and the woman cooed back playfully at her.
"George! George!"
yelled the woman. The man turned round.
"Look after Annie!"
she yelled again.
"What's up?" he called.
Her only answer was a giggle of laughter as she disappeared behind a hedge. The child toddled up to its father and took his hand, while the quiet boy took her other hand with relief. She laughed up into their faces, and the man resumed his homily.
"He's a bad, bad boy. He's a very naughty, bad boy."
By and by the woman came shuffling after them. The boy looked furtively around and dropped his sister's hand.
"Come on, me beauty," cried the man, lifting the girl to his shoulder. "He's a bad boy. You have a ride on your daddy."
They went on alone, and the woman joined the boy. He looked up at her with a sad face.
"Oh, my Christ, Johnny," she said, putting her arms around the boy. "What's it been doing to you? Your face is all blood."
"It's only me nose, mother."
"Here," he whispered. "Here's the tanner."
They went together down the hill towards the inn, which had already a light in its windows. The screams from the barn had ceased, and the cart passed them full of young pigs, bloody and subdued. The hill began to resume its old dominion of soft sounds. It was nearly 9 o'clock, and one anxious farmer still made hay, although on this side of the down day had declined, and with a greyness that came not from the sky, but crept up from the world. From the quiet hill, as the last skein of cocks was carted to the stack, you could dimly hear men's voices and the rattle of their gear.
Thanks, Dave, to Malcolm Grieve, and you'll be hearing more readings from Malcolm in future shows.
Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, ends the show with a poem to Margaret Thatcher, who died this year.
Before the coming. In the days before the coming, corpses lined the streets, buried by the neglected rubbish of a nation in retreat. Money was always worthless, inflated by incessant strife. Then she came, she saw, she conquered by plunging home her knife. A modern Boadicea, a fearless warrior queen, who handbagged her opponents and wiped the tables clean. Enemies within were slaughtered, the city was set free, General Pinochet was courted. It was the time of me, me, me. As greed was elevated, the marketplace made God, while new laws generated to beat the unions with a rod. In the world of education she imposed Clause 28, forestalled gay liberation, thinking sex should be kept straight. She was strong and she was ruthless, made Britannia rule again. Her opponents all seemed toothless. She was brilliantly insane. and she ruled the House of Commons with iron rods and leather whips, as her acolytes all quivered, lusting for her cherry lips. Yes, some men found her sexy and delighted in her wit, while those who failed to follow were sacked or made to quit. She ruled with deep conviction. She was hard and she was blunt, and the harshness of her policies caused many great affront. But some of us who can remember all those crazy things she did question why her leaving party should cost us 10 million quid.
As Trevor said, an expensive funeral, but then £1.9 billion is lost to the Treasury every year from smuggled cigarettes, and that's not even a television spectacle. Money up in smoke, as they say. That's all from Backchat this week. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrowski. The producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul.
And from me, James Media.
Until next week, goodbye.